the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber, and that was Sarita singing Sunny beautifully, almost to the end. And that was Frank Sinatra saying, "Here's Johnny," the night he had me on the Tonight Show. I was lucky enough to be the first guest he invited when he took over the show. Welcome to John Barber's World, right here live in Las Vegas, the city of one-armed bandits, in a country run by CEOs who are two-armed bandits. You know, America's Latin motto, as you all know, is E pluribus unum, out of many, one. But many astute, informed observers feel a motto today should be Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. In Latin, that is E pluribus unum turbo, which translated out of many, one big mess. That is actual Latin, folks, and to help us to understand what a mess we got into and if we're ever going to get out of it, there is no more astute observer than my cohort, the most informed, the most articulate journalist in the country, creator and author of the very best newsletter, News Vandal. Usually, he's here the last half hour, often saving the show, but tonight, he saves it from the opening bell. A terrific hour with the man of the hour, my learned friend and colleague, Joe Satilli. Joe, happy May Day to you.
Well, thank you very much. You know, with your penchant for effusive praise, I'm surprised you didn't have a longer and more fruitful career in the network television system.
Well,
I mean, that's what it takes, right? You get your knee pads on and you go to town.
Yeah, but the thing is that I only praise when it's very, very truthful. Other than that, I find it very, very difficult.
Which is why, after having really one of the most successful shows in the history of television, you were not able to leverage what you wanted to do with the great Jim Garrison into a further television career. Because if you don't kiss, you don't get. And if you do the opposite of kissing, you really don't get.
That's absolutely true. But you know that something, I must tell you, even though I had no interest in the assassination or Jim Garrison or any of that, and I never really wanted to be doing that, that movie that we just finished together, Joe, is absolutely and totally blessed. And I would like to say something good and positive, because there are a couple of things that are coming up that are very, very positive. But I have learned there's an ancient Hebrew proverb. John Wells, John B. Wells, put him on.
I'm with you. How are you?
My goodness, John, how are you? And what a wonderful surprise.
Well, I'm as surprised as you are. But to answer your question, much better than I deserve. Thank you very much. And you sound fit and strong yourself.
Well, I feel absolutely terrific. But I wasn't expecting to have you on as a guest until the 29th of May, which was John Kennedy's 100th birthday, and I was going to do the broadcast with you right from the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills, where our film opens on the 26th. And then I was hoping, because you are by far the best of all these people that do these shows, and I am such a fan. I was hoping to be able to do your show before you did mine. So anyway, this is indeed a surprise, and why the surprise call?
Well, I'm going to have to fire that PA. That's all there is to it. Or maybe I'll give her a raise on second thought, because I'm getting to talk to you now. But how interesting that you've gotten so deeply into this Kennedy assassination thing. And I'll tell you, when we do our long conversation together, I'll tell you about all of the mystical and completely unexpected, totally unplanned, and amazingly surprising connections between myself just walking the path of life and bumping into all of these different characters that were in one way or another connected to that fateful event on the 22nd November 63, and
I must tell you, John, the fact that you even bring this up is serendipity, because I am not very religious, and I know you are, but I have, and I don't use this word often, but this movie has been absolutely and totally blessed from the very, very beginning, because whenever anything went wrong and it became a step backwards, it suddenly became two steps forward. And I must tell you, if there's something metaphysical at work, there's something in the universe at work that is making this story come to light. And I went last week down to the Lemley Theater in Pasadena, the Lemley Playhouse, because I wanted to, in order for this to qualify for an Oscar, which the first one missed because part one was sold by mistake by my partner to television, therefore it was disqualified for an Oscar. And folks in Hollywood have been helping me make this an Oscar contender. In order to have that happen, John, it has to be in a digital cinema package. That was done, technically. I went down to the theater to view it alone on the screen. I felt like Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard watching my movie. And I must tell you, John, the impact is absolutely enormous. So in any event, I deeply, deeply appreciate your interest in this. I'm a massive fan of yours, have been for years and years. Was thrilled to meet you in Dallas, and I'm truly honored that you would even consider having me on the show before the 26th to talk about this. And I look forward to that long, long conversation. You know what? This, again, is blessed serendipity, because whatever your PA did to put you on the phone tonight, it is a preview of coming attractions with the one and only John B. Wells and his Caravan to Midnight.
Well, may I just say in closing then, may God continue to bless you, and we'll speak soon.
With John, thank you so much indeed, and you have no idea how pleased I am to be coming on your show. And we'll have a magnificent show on the 29th when you come on the actual day of John Kennedy's 100th birthday. And so the film is blessed, and bless you, John. Thank you so much. I will talk to you soon.
Thank you, sir. All right. Take care.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. My, Joe, that's amazing.
It's the magic of live radio.
I mean, that is absolutely amazing. Now, he said he's either going to fire his PA or give him or her a raise. But I was starting to say that there's an ancient Hebrew saying, or is it a Jackie Mason saying?
Well, is there a difference?
Yeah, an ancient Hebrew saying that if somebody asks you how things are going, if they're going great, never say they're growing great. Always say, hey, could be better. Well, anyway, that comes to mind when I think about how things are working out well with the film, because only two times, and I can attest to this honestly, two times in my life I said that out loud, because the ancient Hebrews believed that if you said that and bragged about it to the universe, the gods would conspire to relieve you of your good fortune. Now, That's 5,000 years old. But when I had the AM show, I had the very best talk show in all America. Do you remember the young FCC commissioner, Nicholas Johnson? Does that name ring a bell to you?
It does not ring a bell.
Nicholas Johnson was about 36 years of age, the youngest FCC commissioner ever. I had Tommy and Dick Smothers on my show, and it was when they were having their difficulties with CBS. They were close friends with Nicholas Johnson, who wrote a really good book called How to Talk Back to Television. A really nice-looking fellow, looked like Tyrone Power. He's about 6 feet, three tall. And he called because he wanted to be interviewed on my show, and I interviewed him. He wrote a letter to Leonard Goldenson. I have the letter, who was the president of ABC, and said that they had the most intelligent, the most informative, the most interesting and entertaining talk show host and show in America, mentioning my show. He copied me the letter, and then his PS was, oh my God, I hope I didn't just get you fired. At that point, I said out loud, I am the luckiest person in the world to have this show. When a few years ago, I had been locked out of the United States. Now, how's that? The next week after I booked Jim Garrison, it was gone. Yeah. I was fired. Okay, now we come to Real People. Now, Real People is getting a 50 share, the highest regular share.
Wait. Folks, I'm a television head. I worked in television. I'm a comedy head. I've been watching television and comedy my whole life. And I know what a 50 share is. John, tell the people, what's a 50 share?
A 50 share means half of all people watching television.
Half of all the televisions in America.
That's right. And that time, there were like three networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox was just beginning. And then there was CNN. But half of all television sets that were on were tuned into Real People. That happened to no other show except for their final shows, the final shows of MASH and All of the Family, I Love Lucy. They got those kind of shares. We had them every single week. And, of course, I said, how lucky am I?
And guess what?
I mean, out loud. And then all of a sudden, this thing with George Slaughter defaming Jim Garrison happens, and I'm gone. Yeah. I mean, it just happened that fast. So before Real People got on the air, we only had an order for four specials. Originally, Slaughter had a deal with NBC, and the show was called Country versus City. The shows were going to be country music, country jokes versus city music and city in country, that kind of stuff. Anyway, when ABC turned me down and George Slaughter bumped into me by accident one day, he said, why don't you come here and do your show? So we had these four specials. The very first special, I had predicted a year earlier that I was going to change the face of American television with what I call the entertainment of reality, but nobody knew me and everybody thought I was nuts anyway. When we got the order for the first show, my wife, Sarita, went out to a goldsmith and had two gold necklaces made. They said, Real People, number one. A year later, she called Slaughter and she said, do you have time for me to come into the office? I have something for you. And she brought in the two necklaces. Now, the other thing is,
Wait, time out. I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Because let the folks know. I mean, it's interesting how John and I have hooked up. We hooked up over the Kennedy assassination, of course, through a book production house, a publisher down in Southern California with another tangential connection because of my obsession with the Kennedy assassination, which is dwarfed in knowledge and gravitas by John's and others. But I've always been interested in. As I was growing up, I was a child of television. My first memories, age 3, are of the Flip Wilson show. and Geraldine. And of Gerald, I mean, Flip Wilson, actually, what an amazing innovator in that format.
The devil made me do it. The devil made me do it.
And I remember watching the Watergate hearings and so on and so forth. And Real People was something that I watched when I was a young, I guess I would be like a preteen. And that's where I was introduced to you, John. I was introduced to Mark Russell and to this format. And so the question I want to ask you is, because there's something about the format of Real People that reminds me of the thing that I was attracted to doing news magazine production, which is going out and finding people and finding their stories. And what you find when you find people and their stories is you find that their stories are actually better than anything that you can write yourself.
You're absolutely right. And that's indeed how it happened. So you're telling me where the idea came from?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what was it? Because you were doing, was it something that you saw interacting with audiences when you were doing stand-up? Was it something that you observed in interviewing people when you were on doing your...
No, I have, you know, as a kid, I spent most of my time either on a rink or in police custody or in a library. And I loved reading short stories. I loved O. Henry. I loved Guy de Maupassant. I read everything I could get my. I used to read stories to my class when I was 6 and 7 years old, the stories of Gordon Sinclair, a wonderful short story writer in Canada. So I've been attracted to stories, okay? I used to escape into them. As a matter of fact, I almost memorized all the Edgar Rice Burroughs Tarzan books, because when I was 12, I was convinced that I was going to move to Africa and swing through the trees and live there. And when I got to be 14, I saw a documentary where they showed all these bugs in Africa eating people, and they changed my mind. But anyway, when I was a critic at NBC, the Newswire was in the room right behind me. And the Newswire's nickname was Reliable Sources. And often I would just go back there and look at the stories that came in. And a number of times stories would come in that would say, not for broadcast, but there would still be a story there. It would come from Reuters or UPS or something like that. The first one I read was something called the Nub Club. Evidently, it was a small club in Mississippi made up of poor people and rural farmers. These people got to collect government benefits, either from the state or the federal government, if they were somehow deprived of a finger or a toe or hurt. You know, it took the place of Social Security. What these people would do would shoot off a finger or shoot off a toe, they formed this club. It was called the Nub Club. Well, and then there was another one I found, not for broadcast. A stunning brunette in New York City, about 5 feet 8 inches tall. She looked like a brunette Anita Ekberg. I don't know if you remember it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. One of the most stunning, most beautifully built blonde women in the world. Well, this is a brunette version, and she called herself the stripper for God. And her credo and belief was that God had made her naked and beautiful for all men to see.
Well, I could, if nothing else, she was a great marketer.
She was, because the place was always packed, because she said she would always give donations to the church. And of course, not wearing a bikini or a top, there was no place for the guys to stick the $10 bills. But she had a lot of them. Anyway, I gathered up these stories. And the first person I talked to was the best producer of movies in America. His name was Ray Stark. Gosh, you know, I didn't want to get started on this story, but I'll tell you briefly about Ray Stark. Ray Stark was married to Fanny Bryce's daughter. He was the Hollywood elite. And he did The Way We Were, Funny Girl. I mean, boy, that guy, he made a lot of great movies.
Yep.
Okay, he calls me one day out of the blue. And he said, would you come over and chat with me? And I was reluctant to meet with any producer. I said, well, you're not going to show me a movie, are you? Because I think that's a bit of a conflict. No. He said, I want to talk to you about a movie, though, that has not been made. So I said, okay. So I went over it. God, I mean, his office was like the Beverly Hills Hotel on the Warner Brothers lot. He had his own private dining room, and we had a private waiter and everything. It turned out at one time he had been a literary agent. His agent, he was agent to Ben Heck, who was my favorite American writer outside of Mark Twain. So we got along great. And then he said to me, if you were going to make a movie, he said, I love reading your reviews, but if you were going to make a movie, what would you do? What do you think is wrong with movies? So I said, the first thing that's wrong with movies is they're not about people. They're about things and they're about events. And nobody seems to have a job. You don't even know what society you're in. He said, so what would you do if you were going to write a movie? I said, well, I would write a love story because I love love stories. And I have the people meet on a New Year's Day. And in the background, there's a television set with the news going on. Then it's their story. And at the end of the movie, they're in front of a television set again. And we've seen what's happened in that year. But during many of the scenes, they talk or other people talk. And there's a television set in the background. And he said, if I offered you $50,000, would you write it? And I said, no, I'm not a screenwriter. I'm not a screenwriter. I'm just a critic. I can write 3 pages. I can't write 103 pages. He said, I will give you $15,000 now, $15,000 later when you deliver it, and $20,000 when we make the film. And I said, no, I can't do that. And he said, well, what on earth do you want to do? You just can't be a critic. And I said, I have this show, Real People. And I told him the stories. He started laughing. He said, I don't want to get into television, but I'm going to talk to my office about that. And his office was the William Morris Agency. The next week, his guy at the William Morris Agency called me to apologize. They do not want Ray Stark doing television, just movies. But when I was talking to him, he said something very, very interesting. He said, John, you know what? Most movies are crap. And he said, but I get the pickings of the best crap in town. And a lot of people that I met in his position did not, they denigrated what it was they were doing. That's why so many of them were on dope, or so many of them were on alcohol, or so many were promiscuous. They got into the business hoping to do something meaningful and had to succumb rather than doing the show. In show business, they had to, it was business show. They had to do the business. So anyway, that's
but that's now that's in spite of organizations like United Artists, where, you know, the 70s was that transition period, because I actually think the 70s is one of the golden ages of filmmaking.
It absolutely was. Look, at Network was done in the 70s, and there was a wonderful documentary called Hearts and Minds.
Oh, that's, you can watch that 100 times and still
find it. Yeah, but you know that Hearts and Minds was never going to be released. It wasn't going to be released until I had read about it in the Congressional Journal. A congressman had read something into the Congressional Journal about this documentary, Hearts and Minds. I forget. The guy that did it did 5 Easy Pieces with Jack Nicholson. Yep. He was the producer of it, okay? Columbia would not release it. And so I called him to book him on my show. I had a show on Saturday night called the 19-Inch Variety Show. I said, come on and talk about it and bring a clip. And he said, I got a better idea for you, John. I said, what is that? You saw this guy, John Gabron, went into Griffith Park and he started to try to shoot people with a rifle. He was claimed he was an assassin for the CIA in Vietnam. And he had a flashback on the hill and the helicopters came over. He said, it was all over your news. And I said, yes. He said, why not interview him? And I said, he's locked up. He said, I'll get him out of jail for you. I said, are you kidding? I said, would he come on the show? Would they let me have him on the show? He says, sure. Everybody thinks he's nuts, but he's not nuts, and I'll get him on. He came on the show. We took him back to Griffith Park, sat him down, and recreated that conversation that he had with the police and the intelligence agencies. And he gave us the names of the people that gave him slips of paper of prominent people in Vietnam whom he assassinated. After the show, they took him away to Letterman Hospital in San Francisco and drugged him, and you never heard from him again.
Yeah.
And then my friend Bob Rafelson released Hearts and Minds after that. So,
throughout, I mean, I don't know if listeners know this. I mean, you started as a stand-up comedian, and
I started out as an actor. When I went to England to look for my father, who'd gone to the peace and quiet of World War II, and left me at six, and never came back after the war. When you know you've been abandoned, you're always looking for some kind of roots and some kind of meaning. So I went over there. I finally tracked him down. He was a very, very successful ad. He owned an ad agency, Angus Barber McLaren Advertising Agency, on Soquhall Hall Street in Glasgow or Edinburgh in Scotland. He was going to adopt me. And I had these great visions of being Montgomery Clift from Place in the Sun. You remember the film?
Sure.
Here's this poor guy married to or about to get married to Shelley Winters, this shrug who's pregnant. And he wants to kill her so he can marry this most gorgeous woman in the world, Liz Taylor. Well, I had visions of being adopted by this very, very wealthy man who had remarried without ever divorcing my mother. And he took me into a session. They were recording a session. You've seen these commercials, the Pillsbury Doughboy commercials?
Of course.
Okay. Well, they had them. You know, it's an international product. He was doing their commercial in Scotland. And it turned out he was the singing voice, and boy, he sang beautifully. Me, I was tone deaf. I love singers. I'm married to singers. Love singers. And I was so impressed, and the more I saw it, the more, God, I thought I'm going to have this great life. He drove me up there in a limousine, and I got nothing. I got just one suit, one shirt, and one tie. And then I started thinking about him. And when it was over, when he was done, I looked at him and I said, Dad, do you mean to tell me that you gave up three young children and you gave up my mother to come over here and fight against the Germans to end up singing to a donut? Well, you should have seen his face. It turned so red. I mean, if he had a gun, he would have shot me. That ended my relationship with my father. So on the train back to London,
but it sounds to me like it began your career as a comedian and a cynic.
Well, for some reason or other, often these things would just sprout out of my head before I even thought about it. So when I I was on the train going back to London, and I saw this advertisement. There was a theater company, the Castle Theater, that was holding auditions. And I thought, oh, my God, I love actors. And, you know, I need a job. So I got off the train and auditioned, got the job. And I was with the Castle Theater for nearly a year. And I was like a star because I was from the United States. They thought I was this American kid. I was invited to join the Bristol Old Vic, which next to the Old Vic is the most prestigious theater in Europe. But I turned it down because I didn't want to play make-believe anymore. I wanted to live in the real world. So I snuck back to California. I didn't have any papers. I snuck back there, and I wanted to be... My hero was Jack Tar, and he told these great jokes in his monologues at the beginning of the show. So I said, that's what I wanted to do. So I didn't write. I didn't know I could write. So I bought every single joke book I could find, and I was going to steal 8 minutes and get up and do it. But the stuff that was funny, everybody knew, and most of it was terrible. And I thought, well, I can write better stuff than that. And I did. And 2 weeks later, I auditioned at the Horn with Jim Nabors, who just come in from the hills with this hillbilly act and this great tenor voice. And we started together at the Horn in there. And I remember he told me, he used to watch me all the time because he'd go, ooh, and aw, because I did a lot of very controversial things. And then he said to me, when he got his first break on television, he pulled me aside and he said, John, in the way he talked, you know, he said, John, let me tell you something. Talent doesn't mean anything in this town. Friendliness means everything. So he said, if I were you, I'd be careful about some of the jokes you tell, and I'd be a lot friendlier to the folks that you tell them to. And he was right. He was absolutely and totally right. It was great advice. Anyway, I didn't mean to get sidetracked because I want to talk about you and your story.
No. Because, well, here's the thing is that for folks who are listening, this is actually something, this is an area in which you and I share something, which is a lifelong love and obsession with comedy, with True. The nature of comedy, what jokes are, because you talk about doing controversial jokes at that time. What's the time frame of that with you and Jim Nabors? That's
still, right.
What time was that? Was that 58, 59, 60, 61?
No. Let's see. It would be my first professional job was in 1963 at a place called Pike's Peak in Glendale. And my second professional job was in September of 1963 at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco. So
this is a time when comedy is transitioning out of the Catskill
into
really relevant, topical, hard-hitting controversy. It's about pushing. Comedy was no longer about getting them to laugh, buying a couple drinks, and forget about how crappy the dinner was. It was actually about pushing boundaries and
it was about something. And you know, there was a camaraderie amongst all comics in those days. I mean, people would help one another. My most encouragement came from a fellow named Mort Lockman. Mort Lockman was from Seattle. He was Bob Hope's head writer for 25 years.
Oh, what a gig that is. Holy
cow. And I have no job. I'm not doing anything, but I'm interested in comedy. And he says you should do stand-up because you say a lot of funny things. But I tell you how sharp he was. When Sarita got pregnant with Christopher, the first thing he said to all his friends, look at Johnny Barber. He had to grow his own friend. I love that stuff. He had that kind of wit. So I got that encouragement there. But you know, he wrote a brilliant joke. It was at the time of Sputnik. And this was just a few years after this. And the joke was, it proves that the Russians have better German scientists than we do. Which is a great joke something, because it brings up Operation Paperclip and all of this stuff. Well, Bob Hope said, you know, this really isn't my kind of joke. I'll give it to Mort Saul. And he gave the joke to Mort Saul. Well, people did that all the time. All the time. That kind of camaraderie not only does not exist in the business, it doesn't exist in America anymore. Do you know that I got the AM show? It was a Mexican-American Chinese fellow who was the best announcer in Los Angeles. Gosh, I wish I could remember his name offhand. He came to see me at the Ice House in Pasadena, where Steve Martin was getting started. A group called The Association was getting started, a singing group. Cherish was one of their huge hits. That's where Steve started. That's where I was getting up to work up material. Anyway, he came to me. He said, John, they're holding auditions for a news show at ABC, the local ABC station. He said, I just auditioned today. I think you should audition. And I said to him, hold on a second. Why would you ask me to audition? First of all, I'm not a newsman. I said, you do the news. I don't do the news. I'm a comic. He said, well, I just think you'd be perfect for it. Why don't you go over? And I thought, my God, who would do that? I went over and auditioned. I auditioned against 50 people. Some of them were famous. And I got the job 2 days later. 2 days later, I got the job. But management hated me because, as a matter of fact, what had happened, and it's pointed out, I guess, in the documentary, The American Media, in the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In those days, a company could only own 5 television stations, and their licenses were often challenged. There were 1,500 owners of television stations in America then. Now there are only 6.
Well, and because everything was broadcast, we forget this, because there was a time at which you had to apply for a license to have to basically rent a portion of the airwaves over which people received your broadcast.
It was called the public airwaves.
Public airwaves. And to do that, this is why if you go back, and I'm an assiduous reader of old television guides, I just find them fascinating. It's almost like archaeology of the American culture. You can go back and see on a day-to-day basis what it was being consumed, what was not being consumed. If you go back, and because I watched television my whole childhood, like incredible amount of television, more television than probably anybody you've ever met. But when you go back and read these TV guides, you find this inordinate amount of educational programming, public interest programming, religious programming. You find
some of them were wonderful. I mean, Alastair Cook.
Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
And why were those time slots allotted? Because the FCC had public interest and public service requirements. A certain amount of educational programming for children had to be aired if you wanted to keep your FCC license. So one of the things that the coming of cable has done is has discombobulated and altered that process over the course of the years, in addition to the deregulation, the deregulatory steps that have happened. You no longer really have to have the same amount of public interest, public service programming to ensure your FCC license. And now FCC licenses are basically handed out like Halloween candy to anybody who has contributed to the right person.
Well, the thing in that day, the reason they started this show is because there was a huge group of Chicanos, hundreds and hundreds of them, protesting the inability of their news to cover what was happening in the Chicano community. So what they were going to do is, as a sop to the Chicanos and as a sop to the FCC, they were going to start a morning news show. So it was really a throwaway show. They had no idea that Johnny Barber would turn it into the number one show in Los Angeles. And I, in the beginning, I told them, first thing I want to do is I want to open up the phone so people can call in. They said, no, this is not San Francisco. We have dumb people living in this town. The station manager's name was John McMahon. His program director was Larry Einhorn. Now, the producer, Brad Lockman, at first I said his talent was being tall. He was about 6'5". But he stuck up for me in that meeting. And I said, because if you hold an interesting conversation and open up the phones, that will help. I said, the other thing I want to do is movie reviews. And they said, people don't go to the movies anymore. I said, well, they may not go to the movies, but they love to hear stuff about celebrities and movie stars. They said, you're not going to do it. I did it on my first show because I was live and they couldn't stop me. Then, get this, the newscaster... They were number 3 in news at 5 o'clock at night, 6 o'clock. The newscaster was a guy named Bill Bonds. And I said, in 4 months, Bill Bonds will be the number one anchor man because of my show. Well, they looked at me like I was stupid. And they said, you know, real haughty fashion, well, Mr. Barber, what makes you say that? I hadn't even done my first show. And I said, what happens in the morning when people go to work? And they stare at me, so they don't answer me. I said, they turn off the TV set. I said it really loud. I said, they come home at the end of a hard day. What did they do when they come up to the set? They didn't answer again. I said, they turn it on. And what do they turn it on to? The channel they watched in the morning. They're going to watch my show in the morning. In 4 months, Bill Bonds was the number one anchor man in Los Angeles over Jerry Dunphy, who for years had been the number one anchor man. But they always hated me. I'm going to tell you a story that people may or may not be interested in, but I'm going to tell you this story anyway, because it's about the Chicanos. They were having a huge march in Los Angeles. 20,000 Mexican Americans marching on City Hall, demanding justice in the courts and in the media. And nobody covered that story. Two young men I had on, Rosalia Munoz and Gonzalo Javier. I can remember their names to this day. They came on for an hour and we talked about nothing except Chicanos. We got unbelievable phone calls. Now, the march takes place because these are two of the organizers. There is a great columnist for the Los Angeles Times by the name of Ruben Salazar. He is shot and killed by a tear gas canister by an LA police officer. So there are enormous riots. Dozens and dozens of people are arrested. And one of the people arrested is a fellow named Corky Gonzalez. Name nobody's heard of, but they've heard the name Cesar Chavez. About 3 months later, Cesar Chavez is subpoenaed to come as a witness, a character witness for Corky Gonzalez. He says, you don't have to subpoena me, I'll be there. He called our show and he said, can I come on your show? Now, this is Cesar Chavez, the most famous man next to Robert Kennedy, the recent Robert Kennedy in the country. The most revered labor figure, I mean, around the world, is this fella here, this farmer. So we agreed to have him. Of course, we're thrilled to have him on the show. Now, let me tell you something. I had people on the show that made news all the time. Jane Fonda, Hanoi Jane, when nobody would put Muhammad Ali on the show, I had him on the show. We had people on the show that made news. They would never take a clip of my show and show it on the news. They would always come into the studio, drag my guest off to the side because John McMahon hated me. Absolutely hated me. Okay, so we do the show with Cesar Chavez. There are at least 50 news people from the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, crowding around that studio behind the cameras, Joe, waiting for me to finish. During the second to last commercial break, I'm sitting next to Mr. Chavez. He's got on this plaid shirt and he's got on jeans. That's how he dresses, okay? A very sweet soul, a very gentle, quiet man. And I felt like a jerk. And I turned to him and I whispered, I said, Mr. Chavez, I feel like a real jerk right now. But I'm going to ask you the most egotistical and the most horrible question I could ever ask you. And he just stared at me, wondered, what am I up to? So I told him that I had all these wonderful people on, but management hated me and would never show a clip. And I said, I assure you, when we are over, you see those 50 bloodhounds out there, they're going to grab you, take you out in the alley. They won't even ask you questions as well and as smartly as I did, or they'll steal some of my questions and then they'll show the clip on the news. And he's still staring at me. And I felt more ashamed than ever because he didn't talk to me. So I kept going. And I said, when they come over, would you do me a favor and tell them you can't go out there because you have a sore back from picking grapes? He was silent again. And I thought, oh, God, how dreadful of me. What an egomaniac. What a showbiz jerk. So when he had waited, the interview ended. there was a storm of people around him and around me. It was like the wagon trains in the West, only I was the Indian that they were kicking out. And they said to him, "Please, Mr. Chavez, would you come outside? We would like to interview." And they had numbers. They'd all taken numbers like they were at Baskin Robbins to see who would interview him next. He paused the longest moment. He said, "I wish I could, but I can't. I have a bad back from picking grapes."
Nice.
And that made my career on that show, because they ran it on the news and the ratings almost doubled. Almost doubled. But that happened to me all the time. Now get this.
When I But that happened to you because you were willing to take a risk.
It wasn't a risk. It was self-interest, and it was rage and anger at the system. I mean, I knew I had a good show. I'm not an idiot. I mean, Fred Astaire knew he could dance, right?
Right.
Well, he had a lot of people who would say Fred Astaire is a great dancer. I never had anybody who would say John Barber's a great host. So I had to say it myself, so I sounded like a jerk. And with him, I did. I behaved like a jerk. But get this. I booked Garrison on the show, and I'm fired. And I'm telling you, John McMahon was never so happy. He was so afraid of what I was going to say after I knew I had been fired, because I had the show for a week. I could have said anything I wanted. But I was a pro, okay? And I continued to do the shows. Now I end up at NBC a couple of years later as their critic at large, hired by a really wonderful general manager. God, he was terrific. When he hired me, he came into my office. I had this tiny office. He said, "John, my wife and myself, we love your reviews. We watch you on Channel 11, 11 o'clock at night. I mean, it just 10 o'clock at night. They're just wonderful." And then he started to giggle. He said, "You know, but there's somebody here that didn't want me to hire you." And I said, "Who was that?" Because Tom Brokaw's the guy that told them they should hire me. And he said, "John McMahon." I said, "Who? John McMahon?" I said, "Well, isn't he ABC? He said, "No, he's in programming at the network." I got up out of control, and I ran over to the network building, to his office. And I said, "Is McMahon here?" I didn't even call him John. The secretary says, "Well, he's busy." I said, "No, he's not." And I stormed in there, and he wasn't busy. He was at his desk. And I started yelling at him that if he could do his job in the office as well as I could do my job on the air, he'd have been president of ABC instead of Elton Rule, because I was the best host that that network ever had. And I got letters from the FCC commissioner to prove it, for crying out loud. I got tons of reviews to review it. I said, "I'm lousy in an office, but I'm great on the air, okay? If you bother me again, I'm telling you, you will regret it." Well, guess what? When Real People started, he was the programmer from NBC assigned to kiss my ass.
That's karma.
Is that karma? I still have his lip prints. I had to go to a proctologist to get his mouth removed.
Which brings us back to how we started this whole hour, which is, in television, you either go along to get along, or you say it wasn't taking risks. It was self-interest. If you push boundaries and you show something that somebody is not going to see somewhere else, you probably have a formula that's going to work.
Well, you know, I don't know what else to say, but I must tell you and you know who found Sarah Purcell? George Slaughter wanted to hire that tall blonde girl singer that was romancing the short piano player in Arthur, the English actor.
Dudley Moore.
Yeah, who was his
name? Was it Susan Anton?
Yeah, it was Susan Anton. And I said,
Susan Anton, not a. I mean, you know, Susan Anton's not bad, but Sarah Purcell is American.
Listen, hold it. Listen, Susan Anton's a foot taller than Dudley. And yeah. I said to Slaughter, I said, "You cannot have that woman as a host of this show, because everybody's going to look at her and think, what does she see in that midget that she's sleeping with?" I said, you have to have people who are totally unknown. He brought her into Booker anyway. He tried to, God, I'm trying to think of the Jewish comedian, David, something or other.
David Brenner?
No, not David Brenner. There was another Jewish comedian that he brought in to interview as a host. And I said, you can't have him because he's a walking political statement. So we had to, now get this. 2 days later, my son is 10 years of age, Christopher. He says, Dad, you know who you should look at? And I said, who? He said, Sarah Purcell. I said, who's Sarah Purcell? He said, well, he's on the morning show. She's on the morning show with Regis Philbin, and she's really good. You should look at her. So the next morning, I looked at her, and she was adorable. She had been a weather girl or something in San Diego, and now was doing this. So the next day, I brought her in to see Schlatter. She was hired on the spot.
Well, she had that Joan London thing, that, blonde, every woman, Midwest American values looking thing. And then you put her next to Skip Stevenson, who always seemed a little bit sort of leering and risque and sort of the guy
that... And Skip came from the Dinah Shore show. He was a guest on the Dinah Shore show. And a woman named Candace Rockland saw him and said, John, why don't you get him? So we got him. Then I got Freddie Willard. I gave Freddie a job. But the thing is, a week later, George Schlatter brought Christopher into his office and gave him this huge Superman poster to thank him for Sarah Purcell. And 2 years later, when the show became the monster hit, Sarah and George turned into monsters themselves. And it'll all be in the book. The book is Your Mother's Not a Virgin. The stories in the book are unbelievable. But now, you and I are going to have to do another hour after the movie. But what I was going to say about the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy, which is by far the most definitive film ever made or that will ever be made about the who and why and how the murder of John Kennedy, because there will never be another law enforcement officer or human being in this country as brave and as articulate as Jim Garrison. And he tells his story. But this is the first time since Real People that I've ever felt that this film could be a monster hit.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, John, is that we are moving to a stage of American history when the assassination is going from event that has a real impact on the lives of the people who both experienced it or the people who bobbed in the wake of the event as it barreled through the ocean of American history, to becoming part of the canon of history, becoming part of a book. We're talking about millennials who are growing up in a world in which their seminal event is 9/11.
Yes.
So for them, it's an opportunity to be introduced to something, to an event that they may not understand is actually still resonating and having an impact on the way the America that they live in, the way that America works, the way it functions, and why it functions the way it does.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I thought, oh, this is never going to happen, because I read your post when you said you were going to be a guest on the show and see if you could do Turnabout, And I thought, no way, because I had so many questions I had to ask you about great stuff in the news, Vandal. And there you go. It's almost the end of the hour. I haven't asked you one simple question. And, you know, you fooled me. You tricked me.
Well, John, I was a television producer, a television journalist, reporter for many, many years, an executive producer. You know, it's funny. My show was canceled as we were winning our second Emmy because I was trying to do a story about depleted uranium. So, it's the opportunity to let you tell your story is an opportunity that I can't pass up. And it's the same opportunity that you took advantage of when you started Real People. It's the opportunity to let people tell their stories. because that's actually the thing that creates the humanity that binds us together. And it's the humanity that you mentioned is no longer extant in America right now, whether it's comedians helping one another, sharing one another, people in television helping and sharing one another. We live in an America in which it's our dominant ism is anti-socialism, not anti-socialism as in socialism, the political idea. We are anti-social as a matter of course, that anti-social feeling we have.
To that point, I have to tell you a very quick story that I told on Rents the other night, because it shows how it's a story that reveals what people will do to get affection and what people will do to get money these days. Anyway, it was sent in to me by a fella who said that he was almost my age. And he said, you know, that the elderly sometimes succumb to loneliness and they're really great targets for scams. And he said that he ran into this dreadful scam a few weeks ago. He said he went to Home Depot and he bought some stuff and he put it in the trunk of his car, was ready to get in the car, and these two very attractive ladies with rags and a pail of water and their sponge in their hands came up to his car and started wiping the windshield and cleaning the fenders and the bumper and the windows and stuff. And this happens often in the streets. And anyway, so he wanted to give them a tip, and they said, no, drive us to McDonald's. So he invited them in the car. He said, I'm on the way to McDonald's. One of the girls started disrobing, and the other one picked his pocket. He said, just be careful about this. He says, because I've lost my wallet 3 times this week. Anyway, Joe, thank you so much. We will do an hour where I talk to you next time, okay? And we will probably see you May 26th at the Music Hall Theater where we premiere the film. Thank you, Joe, so much for a wonderful, wonderful time. I hope you had a wonderful time. I want to thank Doug. I want to thank my producer, Mike Kim, without whom I could not do this show, and I couldn't do it without Joe. Thank you all so very, very much. Be sure to listen to Ocelli tomorrow, where you can hear Joe Satilli finally talking about the news. To all of you, good night and good luck. You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.